Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're looking a bit off the beaten path, far away from the usual polished corporate stories, you know, the ones baked in marketing meetings.
Right. We're digging into sources that suggest some really iconic figures, the ones everyone recognizes maybe weren't born in a sterile boardroom.
Exactly. Some seem to have emerged from, well, frankly, chaotic local situations, sometimes really strange, unverified events.
And that's really the heart of it today. We're tracing this unnerving lineage of one particular character. You know, the one, the red hair, the yellow suit?
Oh, yeah, yes, that one.
And specifically how a series of very local, very disturbing alleged events, we're talking alleged trauma, involuntary psychological stuff, how that transformed a local performer's specific quirks into a permanent corporate template. Highly marketable, yes, but...
Yeah. We've had a really interesting set of documents here. Primarily, we're using an index on cultural myths. We call it the Inspector Story. And also some detailed archival notes. They focus on the crucial period, 1963 to 1967, and they really seem to outline this dark origin for a regional burger chain's first mascot.
It's more than just history, isn't it? It feels like looking at the blueprints for attention itself, how it's built, how it's commanded.
Yeah. So our mission, really, is to trace that specific timeline to understand how a very particular way of waving, a certain stance, even a specific smile, how that became codified power that, you know, lasts for decades.
The core question, and it's kind of chilling when you frame it this way, is how does a simple physical gesture, something a person does, turn into this inescapable symbol, something that forces you to look? Involuntary fixation.
It really flips the script on brand success, doesn't it? We usually think, oh, big ad budgets, clever campaigns.
Right, the usual metrics.
But what if that real staying power, the kind that lasts generations, doesn't come from marketing? What if it comes from something deeper, something that locked into the collective psyche right at a specific unsettling moment?
We really need to pinpoint where the human performer, the person, ended, and the reproducible thing, the artifact, began.
Okay, so to understand the artifact, we need to start with the man. Let's set the scene. 1963.
Exactly. Let's unpack that initial setup.
So 1963, a regional burger chain is opening its first big location, Washington, D.C. This was a major gamble for them, an expansion.
It needed something big, something memorable.
Right. They needed a presence, not just friendly, but instantly trustworthy, compelling. And they didn't just hire some actor. The sources are clear. They hired a local circus figure known as Friendly Smile.
And that name, Friendly Smile, it really speaks volumes, doesn't it? But that initial trust factor.
Totally. He wasn't some unknown quantity.
No, he was known in the community, specifically for working with kids. The notes really stress this. Parents felt comfortable immediately, saw him as, you know, safe, familiar.
And this baseline trust, this assumed safety, that's what makes everything that follows feel so wrong, so dissonant. It's key to the power of the legend.
Definitely. And the look of the character, the visual identity, was set right from that opening day. Designed for maximum impact.
Yeah.
You know, instant recognition.
We're talking about the core elements that are still used today. That shock of bright red hair, the oversized, almost blindingly yellow suit, and that wide, fixed smile. An impossible smile, really.
High contrast. Engineered to stand out. Be approachable.
It was meant to be this beacon, right? A friendly face in the crowd at a busy grand opening.
A safe harbor. But that carefully built sense of safety just shattered. Almost immediately, the whole corporate plan went sideways because of one event. The sources call it the inflection point.
This is where everything changes. During the chaos of that 1963 grand opening, the notes state very clearly, three children went missing.
Missing.
Last seen near the performer, near the edge of the parking lot. For a brand new family restaurant, this isn't just bad PR, it's potentially fatal.
The search, according to these notes, went on for 6 hours. Six agonizing hours. Police, volunteers, combing the area.
That duration itself, 6 hours, it's just this terrifying blank space in the story.
And when they were finally found, the image described is, well, it's disturbing. Found wandering near the dumpsters, behind the brand new restaurant.
That location detail crops up a lot in the notes. Near the dumpsters, a sort of ignored back of house space. Physically, the kids were okay, unharmed.
But emotionally.
Yeah.
Psychologically, something profound had changed. They couldn't speak normally. They were just silent.
And it wasn't just being quiet, right? The notes describe it more like an inability. They couldn't narrate what happened, couldn't explain, like a cognitive block.
Yeah, they could respond to simple instructions, apparently, but ask about those 6 hours? Nothing, just silence.
Yeah.
And One other thing. This single obsessive activity.
Which brings us to the concrete evidence, the thing that replaced their words. They weren't just scribbling, were they?
No. Not random drawings, not monsters, or anything you might expect. It was constant, persistent drawing. Repetitive. Of the same figure.
The red hair, the yellow suit, the wide, unmoving smile. A perfect visual echo of the performer.
This is where some sources start talking about a forced neurological shift. The idea that whatever happened, the trauma, or maybe just the sheer intensity of the stimulus, it was so strong, it made their minds default to that single visual.
So the image itself became the memory, overriding language, overriding explanation.
That's the implication. It's like the visual channel was so overloaded, it just shut down the verbal one.
Wow. Okay, wait. Was there any mention of, like, serious medical follow-up? Or did the company just go straight into damage control mode?
The notes mention a brief psychiatric observation. Very brief. Almost perfunctory, it sounds like. It confirmed the nonverbal state. But the company's focus, even back then, was overwhelmingly on managing the story, containing the media fallout.
They were terrified. Terrified the link between their shiny new mascot and these silent children would get out beyond DC.
Exactly. So the immediate concern wasn't the kids' well-being, really. It was preserving the asset, the visual identity, which ironically was proving its power at the exact moment it was showing this terrifying side effect.
The figure's visual imprint was so strong, maybe so, unnervingly focused, it became the only way into the memory, locking language out.
The image gained power through silence. Mm-hmm. And this whole pattern, the silence, the drawing. Tragically, it was just the beginning. It was about to repeat and escalate over the next 4 years.
Now, you'd think, logically, after anything like that kids found silent, drawing your mascot near a dumpster, you'd cut ties. Immediately, no question.
That would be the rational corporate move, wouldn't it? But that's absolutely not what happened. They saw the magnetism, the value in it.
So the fact is, despite this deeply disturbing incident, the performer, friendly smile, stayed on. He kept working.
Yep, kept on staff. The internal justification, according to these notes, was that he was just undeniably effective. And the incidents, isolated, unsubstantiated, no physical proof he'd done anything wrong.
So they compartmentalized it. Wrote it off because the mascot was just too valuable.
It seems that way. The economic upside was apparently too high to ignore, even with the darkness around the edges.
And the descriptions of his performances between 63 and 67 really lean into this idea of magnetism. The sources paint a vivid picture.
They do. Crowds weren't just entertained. Children would literally follow him. Anywhere he went on the property, the word used repeatedly is mesmerized.
That's a strong word. Much stronger than just entertained or captivated.
It points to that core theme we keep seeing. Attention as almost like a spell. An involuntary fixation. Not just fun, but something compelling.
There are notes from managers at the time, right? Describing how kids' eyes were just locked onto the yellow suit. Unwavering focus. Even when parents trying to pull their attention away.
Yes. That involuntary focus, that kind of high-priority visual track that was the asset the company had stumbled upon. Or acquired.
During the same period, this mesmerizing tenure, the pattern didn't stop. It got worse.
It intensified. And we have to be careful here. The sources hedge this, and so should we, but reports say.
Right, reports say.
That between 1963 and 1967, a cluster of 17 children allegedly disappeared, temporarily, from the chain's locations.
And specifically at locations where he was performing.
Yes, that's the alleged link. 17 more incidents after the first three. That repetition, 20 alleged cases in total over 4 years, that's what cements this. It moves it from a one-off local tragedy into this persistent, embedded legend.
You can almost feel the panic in the sources describing the regional management back then. Absolute internal dread.
But somehow, that dread was balanced against market performance. How does a family-focused company keep employing someone associated, even allegedly, with 20 disappearances, however short-lived they were?
It must speak to the sheer power of the character's pull. Its success must have been, well, almost unprecedented.
The implication in the sources is a kind of grim cost-benefit analysis. Occasional crisis management was maybe seen as the price you pay for the huge jump in foot traffic the mascot brought in, that magnetism was their edge.
And the outcome for these 17 subsequent incidents, was it the same as the first three?
Eerily consistent, according to the reports. Just like the first time, these children were all found later, sometimes hours later, maybe across town. But always the same result. Physically okay, but silent.
And drawing.
That same compulsive drawing. Red hair, yellow suit, big smile. The pattern just reinforces the narrative. The visual stimulus and this profound, nonverbal psychological impact were somehow inextricably linked.
The figure, the visual template itself, had become this reliable trigger for involuntary absence than involuntary fixation.
It's a cold thought, but the company was, in effect, profiting from a mechanism that seemed to produce silent children.
Which sets up this impossible situation for them, right? Legally, commercially.
Completely. A wildly successful marketing tool, but one allegedly tied to kids vanishing and being found unable to speak. The risk, if this story ever broke nationally, immense.
So, legally, what happened? How did they resolve it?
Well, according to the official record, the performer was never charged. The notes cite the standard reason: insufficient evidence.
No smoking gun.
No physical link. No proof of direct wrongdoing. Just this terrifying, statistically weird pattern involving kids exposed to him.
Insufficient evidence for the police, maybe, but clearly enough for the company internally to say, okay, this has to stop.
Right. They had to make a move.
So they quietly retired him in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Quietly retired.
Insufficient evidence, but they retired him anyway in 1967.
Quietly retired, yes. Removed from the payroll. But crucially, the company kept the character.
Ah. And that is the moment. That's the cold calculation, isn't it?
Absolutely. The person. Too much liability. But the template, the visual, the alleged source of the fixation, that's an asset. Keep it. Codify it.
And the official marketing reason they gave?
Simple. It tested well with children.
Tested well. Okay, but if you dig into what the internal notes say that meant, it's not about happiness or fun, is it?
No. According to the confidential source notes we have, tested well meant fixation. The internal metric was involuntary engagement. The children couldn't look away. They knew. Consciously, or maybe just intuitively, they understood the involuntary nature of that stare, and they marketed that as effectiveness.
The implication is pretty stark. This disturbing power, this ability to command transfixed attention, wasn't a bug. It was a feature, a unique, reproducible market advantage. They had basically bottled an attention spell.
Okay, and this leads to one of the coldest facts in the source material, doesn't it? About how they retained the mascot's design. It wasn't just the look.
No, not just the costume and colors. When the performer was retired, the character template they kept included specific, repeatable actions. Performance details.
What kind of specifics are we talking about?
The notes are quite detailed. Every successor, anyone who wore the suit from 1967 on, was instructed to meticulously copy the original performer's exact mannerisms.
Like what?
The specific angle of his wave, described as slow, deliberate, almost hypnotic. The precise way he moved, his blocking always turning towards the center of the crowd. And even, incredibly, the specific cadence of his laugh, a three-beat rhythm.
Wow. So this isn't just generic be-friendly instructions. This is preserving the ghost in the machine.
Exactly. It's the conscious retention of one specific person's performance quirks, the very quirks present during that whole period of alleged disappearances and silence.
The movement itself was archived, turned from one guy's behavior into a permanent corporate protocol.
The gesture became the protocol. The wave, the smile, they outlived the man.
Hmm.
But they also preserved whatever strange power he seemed to wield over kids' attention.
The power got distilled into the mechanics, making it independent of who was inside the suit.
That's the very definition of codified power, isn't it? The artifact retains the power source long after the human originator is gone, erased.
And that template, those specific mannerisms, they're still out there. This isn't just history. That wave, that smile, they're still operational.
It's an attention template that seems to just bypass normal cognitive resistance. What they captured feels like a nonverbal command system.
And it's still built into the corporate handbook for playing the character. The specific wave, the laugh, the smile, it all persists.
Which brings us to the current connection. The thing that makes this legend feel present, contemporary reports.
What do they say?
The sources mention that even today, parents report this. They notice their children following the clown with their eyes, transfixed, in the exact same way those first kids back in 63 were described, before they stopped speaking.
So the mechanism, whatever it is still functioning.
The power seems to persist because the codified actions persist. It really suggests that whatever happened back then, trauma, a weird psychological effect, maybe just incredibly effective performing it, was inherent to the character's design and actions, not the person.
The mascot isn't just a reminder of the performer. It's like a living document of the involuntary attention he commanded.
And the character's enduring success is almost proof that the company managed to distill something terrifying, unwilling fixation into a consumable, marketable image. The mascot itself becomes an artifact of control.
This is where we can connect it back to some broader themes, right?
Right.
From the Inspector Story Index. These patterns show up elsewhere.
Absolutely. This story of the mesmerizing clown really resonates with key themes we see in systems that hide their control mechanisms in plain sight.
Let's start with that idea of erasure and evidence. The performer vanishes from the official story, retired quietly, but the character lives on bigger than ever.
Precisely. We have a direct parallel in the index, the case of Klaus Richter, the one known as Der Schatten, the shadow. The operating principle there is, erasure becomes the evidence.
Explain that a bit more. How does erasure become evidence here?
Well, with Richter, the system wiped away the man, but the protocols he created kept running invisibly. Here, the very fact the company had to retire the person while deliberately keeping the character's specifics proves the character held this unnerving, profitable power. Power worth separating from the human source.
The quiet exit confirms the power was real.
The character becomes the shadow of the man, carrying the power but shedding the liability.
And there's also that theme about corporate records freezing time, right? Fixing the narrative where they need it to be.
Yes, that links straight to the concept we call Real Wendy. The idea is records can freeze while lives keep moving. The corporate record stops the story at tested well, high performance. It ignores the ongoing, messy reality, the psychological cost, the history.
So the image gets preserved, like in amber, totally cut off from the real events, the silent kids, the dumpsters that gave it its original power. They froze the character at peak magnetic function.
And then there's the systems and control angle. The mascot's function seems like a perfect example of how complex systems maintain control subtly. Through guiding mechanisms.
That involuntary attention, it's a form of hidden control.
It is. It reminds me of how certain, you know, massive theme parks are designed. Every sight line, every pathway is meant to guide you, control your focus, your experience, without you really noticing the strings.
Right. The Disney work principle from the index. Control hides best in plain sight.
Exactly. The mascot's real power isn't overt. It's in that subtle, involuntary command over tension. It's not about persuading you with facts. It's about grabbing your eyes, making you stare, and then normalizing that stare as just part of the brand experience.
And that connects to the final theme, training the audience. The clown trains kids to fixate. That fixation is like step one.
It links directly to that monopoly principle. Complex systems often present as simple games, but the game trains you before it pays you.
How does that apply here?
The character trains the audience's attention, especially children's attention. It teaches them to lock on before it sells them the product. That ability to hold fixation, that's the real product the company captured. Way more valuable than the burgers.
The fixation is the foundation for engagement, for compliance almost.
So this whole deep dive, tracing this local performer, the silent kids, the drawings, it really boils down to this incredible, maybe terrifying piece of cultural engineering. They didn't just make a mascot. They found an involuntary psychological trigger and scaled it up, weaponized it into a national template.
They retired the person and kept the smile. That line from the source material just lands. It sums up the whole cold, efficient transaction perfectly.
The character keeps doing its job, regardless of who's inside. The function persists.
It really leaves you thinking, doesn't it? When a character is so deliberately designed and backed by these accounts to hold attention so tightly that kids reportedly can't look away, what else is that fixation doing? What hidden function might it serve beyond just selling stuff?
If the gaze is mandatory, what comes next?
Yeah, what's downstream from that?
The fixation is the foundation.
A crayon drawing of red hair, yellow suit, and that wide, frozen smile.